Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Paris is the city of light, of boulevard and cathedral, the Seine, the Louvre, Notre Dame, that small café. But historian Graham Robb sees people, generations of Parisians shaping and shaped by the city. Geniuses, generals, criminals, Napoleon, Juliette Gréco, Zola and Madame Zola, François Mitterrand and the angry youth of the banlieue. This hour, On Point, knowing Paris by the lives of Parisians. You can join the conversation beyond the accordion music in the Eiffel Tower and couples kissing along the Seine. What makes Paris, Paris? What's your tale of Parisians? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is historian and writer Graham Robb. His biographies of Balzac, Victor Hugo, and Rimbaud were all selected as the New York Times editor's choice for best books of the year. His book, The Discovery of France, was acclaimed for his unconventional adventurous approach to history. His new book is Parisians, An Adventure History of Paris. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Graham Robb, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Why through the people, sir, and not that wonderful architecture or the cuisine or all the other ways in?
Well, I did want to write about the cuisine and the architecture, but it seemed to me that the best way to know exactly what it was like living in the city at a particular time is to look at the lives of people who lived there, and especially the lives of people who helped to make Paris what it is.
We're going to hear a lot of scenes and vignettes, we hope, from you in this hour, but I guess we kind of want to understand your theory of the case. Do you see Parisians as a breed apart or not? Or do you have a grand theory of what makes Parisians Parisians?
Well, I think the grand theory behind the book was really that there wasn't going to be a grand theory. Mm-hmm. I think if a historian sets out with a moral point or a general ideological point about history, it's very difficult to extract the reality from that, to get a real taste of things. So I did want to avoid doing that. I wanted to do the opposite and to give full attention to particular individual experiences and particular places in the city, partly because I thought it would be more exciting, but also I think it's a more, in some ways, more faithful form of history.
Well, you've got a wonderful lineup of people here, and I just hope we can dive straight in. You go in chronological order here. You've got 20 chapters, the first and last, your sort of accounts of Paris, your first time there. But then in between, everything from Napoleon, pretty much right up to date. And there's this great account you have. We're back in November 1787. As you describe it, a young artillery lieutenant from a regiment recently posted to Valence, 18 years old, afraid of nothing except embarrassment, you write, a little too short for his long leather boots. And here's Napoleon Bonaparte, 18 years old, headed into Paris for only the second time in his life. Take us in with him, Graham.
Well, that's right. He arrived on what was called the water coach, the boat from Auxerre, sailed into the center of Paris and docked among the spires of the medieval city by Notre Dame, found his way to his hotel, and he was actually there on family business. But he had something else in mind. He was 18 years old, and he wanted to lose his virginity. And he knew that the best place to go was the Palais Royal. This is where everyone went in the days before the revolution. You could buy absolutely anything there was to buy in the Palais Royal. And he was conducting a kind of experiment. He was a terribly serious young man. And that's why he left an amazingly detailed account of his first encounter with a prostitute. It reads like an interview. The curious thing about it is that you can see that the prostitute, whom he thought was rather timid and naive, was actually leading him. So it's a wonderful kind of binocular account of his first encounter.
She worked him pretty skillfully, and I was just struck by the tone. Here we've got Napoleon's diary entry. I wonder if you could read just the first four or five paragraphs, maybe down to my evening's work from the entry of Napoleon Bonaparte. This is Thursday, November 22nd, 1787, and he describes his night.
Napoleon says, "I had left the Italien Theatre and was striding along the avenues of the Palais Royal. Stirred by the vigorous sentiments that characterize my soul, I was indifferent to the cold. But as my imagination cooled, I felt the chill of the season and took shelter in the galleries. I was standing on the threshold of those iron gates when my eyes fell on a person of the female sex. From the time of day, the cut of her clothes, and her extreme youth, I deduced without hesitation that she was a whore. I looked at her, and she stopped, not with that martial air of the others, but with an air that was perfectly in keeping with her physical appearance. I was struck by this concordance of manner and demeanour. Her timidity emboldened me, and I spoke to her, I who feel more keenly than any other man the odiousness of her profession, and who have always considered myself soiled by a single glance from one of those creatures. Yet her pale complexion, her frail physique, and her gentle voice caused me to act without delay. Either, I told myself, this person will be of use to me in the observations I wish to make, or else she's simply a dolt. You must be very cold, I said. How can you force yourself to walk these avenues in such weather? Oh, monsieur, hope is my spur. I must finish my evening's work.
From the diaries of Napoleon Bonaparte, you must be very cold. It doesn't take much of a pickup line when we're in this neck of the woods. And here he's stirred by his vigorous sentiments. Yes, indeed, I guess. But he would conquer half the world, conquered here by the frail young woman on the streets of Paris, 1787.
Yes, and it's interesting that he kept the account. He kept that document all through the years of battles and exiles. He never threw it away. It was obviously a crucial moment in his life.
The French men and women who come in to Paris, do you see them, feel them being transformed, changed by Paris, or do they just take it for granted as birthright?
I think almost everyone who went to Paris, especially in that period, was changed by it. And they were aware that they hadn't just gone to another city. They were in the capital of what was soon to be an empire. I think that people, even today, are very, very conscious of being Parisian or at least living in Paris. I think it does still have a huge effect on everyone who sees it.
We want stories here. Marie Antoinette, you've got this great story of her sort of fleeing in her carriage. Tell us why. She takes a wrong turn, and, we all kind of know the outcome, but tell us how she gets there.
Yes, the royal family had understandably decided it was time to leave Paris. It was the time of the revolution. Everything had been planned very, very carefully. There was a special getaway coach waiting around the corner from the palace.
She writes that back at that time, "You cannot imagine the intrigues that are being woven all around us, and every day I make strange discoveries in my own house," 1789.
Yes, and she had a bodyguard who, like Marie Antoinette, knew Paris, lived in Paris. Unfortunately, even though they only had to go 50 yards to get to the coach, they turned the wrong way and got lost almost immediately in this inextricable labyrinth of medieval streets.
The left bank.
On the left bank, yes. They crossed the river and wandered about for quite a long time. And because everyone who was involved in this incident left their memoirs of it and wrote about it, and Marie Antoinette herself, when she was in prison, told her chaplain all about it, we know more or less exactly where they were and where they got lost. And it did strike me, isn't that interesting, that someone who lived in Paris and was supposed to know Paris could so easily get lost? And it turns out there were no reliable maps of the city at the time. If you went there as a tourist, you would probably buy a map by a man called Cointerault, which was called Paris as it is today. And if you looked at the bottom of the map, there was a footnote explaining that he had omitted all the minor streets, because otherwise the map would have looked like chaos. And in fact, most people didn't wander far from home. They stayed in their own quartier.
Only 5.5 miles across central Paris. I mean, that's the same size, for heaven's sakes, as Paris, Texas. You're in a little town in Texas, you remind us. And yet, Marie Antoinette lost in her own city. I guess if your playground is Versailles, it might not be that surprising that you wouldn't know how to make your way through the war and the left bank in those years.
Yes, although she had walked about Paris. She had taken her children out for walks. But the thing is, the Paris we see today, with those lovely broad avenues and boulevards, didn't really exist. There were a few long streets, but it was really, it was this sort of intestinal arrangement of streets that had been there from the early Middle Ages and even earlier. And it was some time before they were all swept away.
You're a Briton, but you've gone so deep on Rimbaud and Balzac and Victor Hugo, all of France in the discovery of France, and now Paris itself. Are you welcomed in your deep explorations, my British friend?
Yes, I found the French very. I think they're interested in having a foreign view of their own country. And actually, when I'm in France and people say, "Are you English?" I say, "Au contraire, I'm Scottish. All my family are Scots. I was born in England." So there is a kind of connection anyway, a historical connection between Scotland and France.
And then here's the question in my mind behind all of this. I mean, you're celebrating all these Parisians, and as the world celebrates Paris, but then so many, whether British or American, you name it, come back from Paris with horror stories about Parisians. And I hope we can delve into that a little bit before we're finished here.
Rue Le Pic. Il y a des cabots et des gosses à poulebots aux frimousses vermeilles qui se prélassent au soleil. Mais surtout, il y a une belle fille aussi belle que l'été. Elle marche en espadrille et rit en liberté. Rue Le Pic.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the people whose stories made Paris, with Balzac, Hugo, and Rimbaud biographer Graham Robb, an American in Paris, and George Gershwin behind us. But he's looking in his new book at the inhabitants of Paris. It's called Parisians, An Adventure History of Paris. He joins us today from Washington. You can join us as well. What do you think? What makes Paris, Paris? Is it the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, the Champs-Élysées? Is it Bonaparte, Proust, Sarkozy, Marie Antoinette? What's your story of interacting with Parisians? Jennifer's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Jennifer, you're on the air with Graham Robb.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was a student in Paris in 67 and 68, and so that was just before the events of May, as it is known. And Paris is very Paris. For instance, speaking to Napoleon's experience and what you started the program with, if I stood on the street corner for 5 minutes waiting for someone, you know, I would be solicited. We had a shoemaker in the 15th arrondissement, which was where there were the ladies of the day and the night were very prominent. So when we went there, the street was lined with these ladies, and it was just part of Paris. And just to say that Paris is so very Paris, and it was a wonderful experience. And thank you for taking my call, and I don't know if you had any questions about that.
Well, it was great to have you, Jennifer. 67 and 68, you're there right in the midst of a period that Graham Robb pays a lot of attention to. Graham, maybe you could take us to some of the Parisians you've looked at in the time Jennifer was there.
Yeah, that was a very exciting time. It was time, in fact, 67 is when the revolution of May 68 really began at the university. It just began as a protest of boys weren't allowed in female dormitories. And that is now recognized as a real revolution. In fact, it wasn't just the students. There was also a general strike. And that's a constant feature of life in Paris. There wasn't just the French Revolution in 1789. There were revolutions all the time. And then in 68, the government was almost overthrown.
And take us into some of the personalities or Parisians who were making that happen. Give us a sense of the people, the young people in this case, who were at the heart of that.
Well, they were, you know, the French education system put them through a very long and an arduous system, and they did live in very difficult circumstances. They had been thrown out to the outer suburbs, to Nanterre in particular, and moved out of the centre of Paris, partly for reasons of security. And the nice thing about writing about May 68 is there's so much evidence about individual lives. And for example, there was a young woman who gave a very interesting interview to a very sexist French television radio interviewer at the time, which provides wonderful insight into what it was like, how difficult it was being a student in Paris at that time. And even just the graffiti, you know, graffiti, which has always been a big, important, interesting part of Paris, was absolutely crucial in the May 68 revolution. And it's, you learn an awful lot just by reading the walls, or at least looking at photographs of what the walls looked like at the time. It's very impressively intellectual, humorous graffiti, which tells you as much as a sociology textbook.
The streets of Paris alive with ideas, ideology, not only revolution, but also conquest at some points. I mean, we're jumping around a little here, but why not? In history, you've got a great retelling of Adolf Hitler's early morning, dawn, really, tour of Paris after his Nazi armies had moved in, June 1940. Take us to that, if you would, Graham.
Hitler always said that he'd wanted to visit Paris, but had been prevented by politics and war, ironically. So finally, when the Nazis invaded northern France, he snuck into Paris at dawn when a lot of the population had fled and had a little tour of Paris monuments. Saw the city when it was completely deserted, the very, very few people about. And his idea was that he was going to rebuild Berlin, and he wanted to see Paris as a model. This was going to help him design the new Berlin. And after he'd seen it, he said, well, I had often wondered if we'd have to annihilate Paris. But when we finish with Berlin, Paris will be nothing but a shadow, so why should we destroy it?
Oh, wow.
That's why Paris was saved at that point.
And what did he? Where did exactly did Adolf Hitler want to go? He who had conquered and could go anywhere he liked at dawn. What did he want to see on his tour of the Paris?
He especially wanted to see the Paris Opera, because he liked that slightly excessive Baroque Second Empire, very florid style. And he particularly liked the big monumental buildings. He liked the Eiffel Tower. He talked about its impressive verticality, which isn't the most original thing you can say about the Eiffel Tower.
No.
But he liked the sort of steel and reinforced concrete and anything that looked grand and big. It was just the size that he liked. And at the end of his tour, they drove up to Montmartre and stopped by the Sacré-Cœur, and he looked down over Paris and found it an anticlimax, because you could hardly see the lines of those huge monumental boulevards and the Champs-Élysées. It looked too human, I think. It looked like a place occupied by human beings, so he didn't like that at all. And he turned around, looked up at the Sacré-Cœur and said, appalling.
So unbelievable.
He didn't like that either.
Unbelievable. It was kind of very creepy, early dawn misty photograph here of him with Albert Speer in front of the Eiffel Tower. Right below it in your book, you've got this photograph of a playground at this time, 1942, in Paris. And you tell the story of Jewish children in not a happy situation around the same time that Hitler was headed in, obviously.
Yes, this was it's called the Rafle du Vel d'Hiv, the roundup of Jews. There were several roundups. This was the biggest one. And they put them for several days in the old velodrome in Paris, where bicycle races took place, before moving them out to Drancy in the suburbs, from where they were sent to concentration camps in the east. And it's a terrible thing to say, but for a historian, it's a wonderful opportunity to really get into the heart of the city, because those who survived left very detailed accounts of their experience of being rounded up and hunted in the city, and trying to survive, those who escaped, trying to survive in basements and attic rooms and trying to discover all the little secret places in the city. And I wanted to tell that story from the point of view of two children in particular who did survive.
Jewish children, surviving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in some ways it's very difficult to present an adult's point of view, because it's just pure horror. Yeah. Whereas with children who don't know exactly what's going on, who know that something terrible is going on, it's in some sense more bearable, and you can follow you can recreate the experience of suddenly finding yourself in your home city as a total foreigner, as an outcast, a fugitive.
Maybe more bearable, but also terrible. Your photograph has a picture of a park with a big sign marking it off saying, "Playground, children only, no Jews." Graham Robb is with us. His new book is Parisians, An Adventure History of Paris. Matthew is calling from Norwood, Massachusetts. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi. I was over there around Christmas time and looking for Mirabeau and Marat's graves. I guess I have to just accept that Mirabeau ended up in the sewers, but everyone says that Marat's in Saint-Étienne-du-Mont, and there's a lot going on in there, but I didn't see any markers for him. Would they actually have buried Marat in a church?
Well, burials of people in the time of the revolution are very hard to retrace, because very often someone would be buried and then their bones would be exhumed and thrown into the drain as a kind of humiliation. And, you know, this happened all through the revolutionary period. There's a wonderful story by Chateaubriand, who was part of a commission after the revolution to go into the charnel house, the ossuary, and find the bones of Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI. And so he went down there, and of course couldn't, especially in those days, you couldn't possibly tell them all apart. And Chateaubriand said that he recognized the queen by her smile, which is a rather ghoulish thought.
And what about Count Mirabeau, who tried to reconcile the church and the rest, and your radical journalist Murat? What do you know of these Parisians, Graham Robb?
I'm not sure where they ended up, actually. And I didn't actually write about Murat in the book, partly because I wanted to approach the revolution from a slightly oblique angle, rather than getting tangled up in the sequence of events, which, you know, you can find in a more conventional analytical history. I did want to sort of try to get into the psychology of the revolution, which is why I want to talk about Marie Antoinette getting lost, because it seemed to express a personal experience of that particular time in a concrete fashion.
Matthew, your effort to find the burial places of these two sounds very Graham Robbish. I mean, it makes Paris real by having a particular, specific angle of investigation.
Well, it's a big place, and it's easy to get overwhelmed, and we were taking our daughters over for the first time, you know, they're 13 and 16, and wanted to make it kind of interesting and give a treasure hunt kind of, you know. So we started at the Pantheon, because we were staying down the street, and we go in and we see, okay, this is where both of these guys used to be, and here is a statue of Mirabeau. And they recognized him from the bust at the MFA. So, you know, the history books or the guidebooks will sometimes say such and so is here or there.
Right.
And it was a way to introduce them to a place and make it interesting for me too.
Absolutely. Thanks for your call, Matthew. Graham, you write about the Baron Haussmann, Georges Eugène Haussmann, who Napoleon III commissioned to redesign Paris. Talk about having a big footprint on the City of Light. He had it.
Yes, he did. Well, Napoleon III, who was the nephew of Napoleon the Great, had been in exile in London when he escaped from prison, and was very impressed with London and thought, wouldn't it be nice if Paris, too, had a Hyde Park and nice little squares everywhere. And when he came back, he had a map of Paris on which he'd drawn in different coloured pencil all the non-existent avenues and boulevards that he wanted to create. And once he became Emperor Napoleon III, he gave this map to Baron Haussmann, who then carried out over the next 20 years almost the plan to transform Paris. So even though Paris was never completely devastated in a war, it was completely devastated in peace when it was rebuilt by Napoleon III.
Paint a picture of the before and after, if you would, for us, Graham. What, he took it from what to what?
Well, it was a lot of it did need to be cleared out, because there were streets that hadn't seen the sun for 1,000 years. It was a very unsanitary place. And there was a photographer who was sent out, fortunately, to take pictures of all the streets and squares that were going to be demolished. And then he was sent out afterwards to take pictures of them after they'd been rebuilt. So you can see exactly in enormous detail what the old Paris looked like and had looked like more or less since the Middle Ages.
1865, he got the commission and produced the Paris we know now with its orderly grandeur.
Yes, I mean, it's that lovely imperial backdrop of a city with its boulevards and its creamy apartment blocks that that we think of as Paris, I think, usually, and yet it's only about, it's just over 150 years old. It's quite a modern city.
Mm. And Baron Haussmann taking a lot of heat from the people he displaced, rich and poor.
Yes, he described Paris as a courtesan who needs all the best furniture and fittings. And he thought that people really should take second place to the city. I think that's partly why Hitler admired what Haussmann had done, because obviously Hitler took a very same approach to his cities.
Yeah, brutally. Heather in Tampa, Florida. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
Good. Just wanted to share my experience in Paris and of the Parisians. I thought the women were incredibly stylish. The way that they dressed, simply going to the market, was always impressed me. I was a student there in 1997 when the World Cup was there as well. So it was a little bit different time with so many other countries coming into Paris. It's, you know, every other week a different country was visiting. But I also loved the Parisian attitude toward dogs. I'm a dog lover as well, and I remember seeing a man in a cafe with his dog on the table with him, with a bowl pouring him water from his Evian bottle as they sat and dined together. And I thought you would only see that in Paris. And I just I love the people there.
Heather, thanks for your call. You know, dogs show up in your book as well, Graham. Here you've got this wonderful photograph of Juliet Greco, who became the lover of Miles Davis. She was sort of the beauty of the existentialist cafe scene, and she's got her little dachshund right there with her.
Yes, it's a little dachshund as a fashion accessory. She has a very nice leather handbag, too.
Just so she's your existentialist, what, ideological revolutionary, but she's got all the style going on here that's talking about.
Yeah, very stylish. It's that lovely late Dior, dark Saint-Germain-des-Prés existentialist style.
And you've got Madame Zola, Emile Zola's wife, the long-suffering.
Yes, who's in many ways more interesting than the great Zola himself, because it was Madame Zola who stayed in Paris during the Dreyfus affair when Zola was forced to flee to London. She's the one that faced the music and received the death threats and the insults. And in fact ran his career for him, really. She was like his agent and his publicist. And yet relatively little is known about her except through her husband. So I thought I did want to write as much as possible about women, often because their experience tells you a lot more about what daily life was like. And you're not quite so swamped by all the professional data of a prominent life.
You've got the description of the Zolas having dinner with friends at the Eiffel Tower.
Yes, lovely Russian restaurant on the first floor of the Eiffel Tower. I think it was Maupassant who famously said that the restaurant in the Eiffel Tower was his favorite part of Paris because it was the only part of Paris from which you couldn't see the Eiffel Tower.
Hier soir, deux inconnus, et ce matin sur l'avenue, deux amoureux tout étourdis par la longue nuit. Et de l'étoile à la concorde, un orchestre a mis le corps, tous les oiseaux du point du jour chantent l'amour. Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées, au soleil, sous la pluie, à midi ou à minuit.
Sous le ciel de Paris coule un fleuve joyeux.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the people whose stories made Paris, with Balzac, Hugo, and Rimbaud biographer Graham Robb. His new book is Parisians, an adventure history of Paris. He joins us from Washington. You can join us. Edith Piaf, too. What's your story of Paris, of interacting with Parisians? Here's a Facebook comment, Graham, from Leslie. Says, my favorite Parisian character is the old man who boxes shirtless in the evenings and sometimes late at night outside the Bastille Metro stop. Everybody's got their snapshot, their picture, their one. Let's go to Jim in Monroe, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air with Graham Robb.
Hi, Graham and Tom. How are
Hi.
You?
Well.
I'd just like to say a little bit about my experience with the French in Paris. I found them to kind of demand a little bit more investment on the front end of a relationship, so that whenever you meet them, they may have a little bit of a hard exterior for a little while. But
just a little?
For a little while. It's worth the investment, though, because unlike Americans who have, like, a little bit more in the way of a throwaway relationships with people, the French, once you've made a friend of a Frenchman, you've made a friend for life. They make you make a little bit more investment, though. They're a little bit more serious about relating to people.
Jim, thanks for your call. Graham, what about it? And this attitude you write about, gouaille, of the Parisians.
Yeah, I think that's a very good comment. It's true that you do have to have a bit more investment. I mean, my own, you know, people often say about New Yorkers that they're rude, but I've always found them exquisitely polite by comparison. And my own breakthrough point in Paris was when I was there as a boy and I was looking for a job. I was waiting to use a call box. There was a man, it was taking quite a long time, and the two Parisian women standing behind me. And one of them said to me, "Knock at the door, knock at the door. He's not allowed to stay in there more than 5 minutes. Why don't you knock?" And then she said, "Ah, it's because you're English." And I had a short temper. And it was the first fluent phrase I ever pronounced in French. I said, "Non, madame, c'est parce que je suis poli." "No, madame, it's because I'm polite." And suddenly everything changed. And her friend said, "Yes, he's right. You're very rude." And they, you know, they were all smiles. And I thought, ah, that's it. You know, if I get angry back, then suddenly the ice is broken.
Right. You're in the game. Is that a little bit of gouaille on your part? How do you define that?
I think so. It's almost a kind of etiquette. You know, it doesn't look like etiquette. It's not necessarily a form of courtesy. But it's probably, you know, it's also the attitude of people who live in a big city. And I think sometimes you have to make a distinction between people who actually come from Paris, who were born in Paris, and people who have come from the provinces and who are a bit self-conscious about being Parisian, who are, in a sense, fake Parisians. And they think there's an image they have to live up to.
There's this hard edge, and then there's the kind of nostalgia, even literally the remembrance of things past story. Marcel Proust is one of the Parisians that you follow here, and his response to modernity coming into his realm, into Paris.
Yeah, it was nice to write about Proust because, like a lot of Parisians of his time, he spent nearly all his time in his room, in his apartment. It was a completely separate little universe inside Paris. And almost like Marie Antoinette, when he went out on his own without his driver, he did sometimes get lost. He'd walk around the block and then forget which house he lived in. So I wanted to write about Proust and also the metro, which actually he never took, which came along at about the time he began to write his novel. He was a great consumer of newfangled toys like the théâtrophone, which is the sort of telephone that would broadcast opera into your apartment. Modern medicines as well. I mean, he was a true Parisian, Marcel Proust.
But why he and others, you say, so fond of staying in their rooms when they had all of Paris at the doorsteps?
Well, it's a sort of Parisian approach to things. You know, it's that Paris isn't just out there in the street. There's also Paris behind all those little windows. This is what Balzac says again and again in the novels of the human comedy. If you want to know Paris, just walk around the streets. Walk around the streets at the time when the light's growing dim and people haven't yet closed their shutters, and you can see into people's rooms and salon, bedrooms and drawing rooms, and imagine all these lives that are going on behind those million windows.
Talking about seeing into all these lives in Paris, you tell the story of a figure I did not know much about, this Vidocq, who was kind of the opposite of Inspector Clouseau, this super effective criminal turned sort of detective or one-man surveillance army. Introduce us to him.
Yeah, he was at one time the most successful criminal in France. He'd broken his way out of practically every major prison. And it was Vidocq who was invited to create the Sûreté Brigade, which was like the FBI. It was a criminal investigation department.
Early, mid-19th century, sort of?
Yeah, very early 19th century, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. And he amassed a huge database of information on all sorts of people, whether they were criminals or not. And when he was finally kicked out, because he was corrupt, he was kicked out, founded his own private detective agency. And because he took all his files with him from the SEAL Team Brigade, his private detective agency was extremely efficient. And he probably knew more about Paris than anyone else. He knew so much that not only did he help the future Napoleon III to escape from prison, he also acted as a kind of consultant, visited him in London, and explained to him exactly what to do if you want to conduct a coup d'etat and take over Paris. And it was obviously very good advice, because the coup d'etat was successful.
Great Paris stories. Vidocq as a master of surveillance and disguise. And when he died, his coffin is open to reveal?
Yes, there's another missing corpse. Yes, it was found recently, actually, that the body inside the coffin is the body of a woman.
Not
which means no one knows when he died or where his remains are.
Michael in Montreal, Canada. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for this topic. There's one man which is perhaps as familiar with Paris as your guest. I don't know if your listeners know him. His name was Walter Benjamin, and he wrote a book called The Arcades, and he strolled about Paris, and he took notes and observations of the city as it changed, and much of his observations about wandering the streets of Paris in this turn of the century, that is between the 19th and 20th century when he was around. That Paris has disappeared forever. I know the city fairly well, and you know, the bookstores, the little boutiques and the bakeries, they've all gone. They've been replaced by sort of shoddy clothing stores and commercial outlets. So that bohemian Paris, I think that's something that's for the history books, perhaps. Your guest has documented that for us.
This will be very disillusioning. Stick with us, Michael. Graham, do you agree? The boutiques and bakeries and... Can that
yes.
be gone? Bohemian Paris gone? Can it be?
Well, I think Paris is always changing. And as you just said, Walter Benjamin is a wonderful guide to Paris. And Benjamin was writing about the poet Charles Baudelaire, who himself is a wonderful guide to that earlier Paris of the mid-19th century. And Baudelaire wrote a poem at the time when that old quartier in which Marie Antoinette had got lost was swept away by Baron Haussmann and replaced by a huge open square. And he said, "The form of a city changes faster, alas, than a human heart." And there is always that, as you mentioned at the start of the program, there is a very tenacious nostalgia that attaches itself to certain quartiers. And I have noticed that people will become very attached to one particular period. And when things change and aren't necessarily immediately replaced by something just as interesting, there is that sense that the city is dying. But I think in some parts of Paris, even though it has been gentrified and homes have turned into offices, there are other parts that are still very lively and interesting and changing all the time.
You write a fair bit about what's extremely contemporary about Paris, but you also brought some mysteries, maybe some answers to light for me. You've got this wonderful photograph of you of Montmartre and with windmills on top. Americans will remember in the movie Moulin Rouge, there's the windmill, Moulin windmill, and I never had understood the connection here. Can you? I mean, you've got this great story of Parisian Henry. Was it how do you say it? Murger,
yeah.
Who serialized he had this unfaithful lover, Lucille, kind of the real life Mimi of La Boheme. He wrote that all up, became very successful. But what about the windmill, the windmills up in this district of Paris? What's that about?
Well, at that time, right for most of the 19th century, Montmartre was still a village on the hill to the north of Paris. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's still a vineyard there, small vineyard. I don't think the wine's very good, but they do grow on the slopes of Montmartre. And for a long time, it was just a village. And, of course, it's a very good place to have windmills. It gradually became... I mean, still now, you can see it is still like a village. But Murger lived lower down, lived on the left bank with the real bohemians. And these were he, as you said, wrote the stories that much later became the Puccini opera. But his original stories about people he knew and people he lived with were simply recordings, like a diary of his daily life. And it's very interesting to go back to that real Bohemia and see what it was like and how cynically it was portrayed.
Out of the Latin Quarter there, and suddenly we've got La Bohème. You don't shrink away at all from very contemporary Paris. And, you know, you've got the story of the modernization, the highway ring around the city, and the banlieue, where we all saw the tremendous riots not so long ago. You point straight to this. This is Paris and Parisians too.
Yes, there's a kind of conjuring trick about Paris to say that Paris is just that beautiful, enchanted enclave inside the Ring Road. Isn't quite true. There's also Greater Paris. I mean, Paris is a huge city, population of more than 10 million. And we have to see that part as Paris too. There are some lovely suburbs. There are also some hideous suburbs, which is where the riots began in 2005. And I did want to write about those, and again, write about them from the point of view of two children, the two boys who died early in the riots.
The immigrant boys, immigrants making up much of that population. I mean, it's more than the center, but you remind us that small island right there in the center, occupied by the Parisi tribe way back, always looked out at these dark woods of the Bondi.
Yes, they were always afraid of that part in particular to the northeast. And if you left Paris in a coach, that's what you hoped to get through, was the forest of Bondi, and get out to the plains of Champagne and the Brie. And there's still probably even more fear aroused by those suburbs today. And there are still people in Paris who won't believe you if you tell them that you've cycled through there and talked to people. And they think it's not possible to go there and come back alive.
And we think we're beyond the Middle Ages. Hakim is calling from Boston. Hakim, you're on the air with Graham Robb.
Yes, thank you for taking my phone call. Mm-hmm. But basically, my comment is a mixture of, it's a political and cultural also, but what intrigues me the most is, after discovering and also, I would say, colonizing Morocco and other part of the world, also Syria, Damascus. In 1959, when Morocco declared officially its independence, we haven't had any French, I mean, basically, it didn't leave any heritage. They didn't leave anything. I mean, people are still speaking French, basically, but
in Morocco.
Damascus, yes. Mm-hmm. So, and we haven't had, the culture is unique. I mean, what I love from the French is the education. But what it is with them is they learn, they want to learn more. Basically, they are takers. They're not giving, they're takers. So all this cafe that you see in Paris, mm-hmm. and all over France, I can trace that basically, historically, from Syria and also Morocco. But I haven't had anything from the French. I mean, they didn't leave us anything. It's just, you know, I wouldn't say politically exploited Morocco, but they were there for a period of time, and we didn't see them anymore.
And what did France and the Parisians give back to you? Hakim, thanks for calling. Graham, what do you think? Parisians, French?
Well, France, yes.
Even the cafes.
France does have a very difficult relationship with its past, and Paris in particular has been very slow to recognize what has happened, especially with their colonies in North Africa. In fact, there was the Paris police massacred hundreds of Algerians who were protesting peacefully. It's 1961, and threw them off the bridge by Notre Dame into the River Seine. It's only very, very recently that a plaque finally went up, although it's very hard to find. It's on the quieter side of the bridge, saying that this is what happened in 1961. And I think even with the riots, we're still seeing the remnants of that colonialist policy, and a quite deliberate attempt to exclude certain parts of the population from the rest of the city.
Is it? How do you end up looking at it, having gone deep into all these Parisian lives? Do you see the eternal city in Paris, or does something finally go away, change, get lost forever? You write about it as a kind of glorious compost heap, in a way, where century on century weighs down what and eventually smothers what came before.
Well, I think what struck me most was the opposite, that it cities aren't eternal. They do disappear. I mean, one of the earliest stories in the book is about the man who discovered that the whole left bank was about to collapse, that underneath were these centuries-old quarries. The stone had just been dug out and leaving the left bank on the brink of collapse. And, you know, when I wrote The Discovery of France, I was writing about remote parts of the provinces, and very often you'd find traces of what life had been like 2,000 years before, whereas in Paris there are whole areas which are physically, materially removed forever.
Gone. And now comes a new city. We've got a little contemporary rap out of the banlieue around us right here. It takes all kinds these days to make up Paris, to make up Parisians. Grand Rob, it's been great speaking with you this hour. It's just wonderful. We thank you for your time there and everything you've brought us in Parisians and Adventure History of Paris. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for your tales, your connections with Paris and Parisians. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Les journalistes font des mots de la violence à l'école existait déjà. De mon temps, les rackets, les bastons, les dégâts. Les coups de patte dans les pare-brises, des tirs des instituteurs. Embrouille à coups de cutter, mais en parler au journal tous les soirs, ça devient banal. Ça s'imprime dans la rétine comme situation.